BBC.
BBC.
Hello and welcome to Witness on the BBC World Service with me, Claire Bowes. Today we're looking back at a key moment in the history of the internet. In 1997, the US Supreme Court ruled that sexually explicit language could be used online. This overturned a US law signed the previous year, which sought to censor the internet to protect children from sexual content. I've been speaking to the lawyer who fought the case for freedom of speech.
Finally, I get to teach a whole lesson all by myself. And I'm going to teach something relevant, something modern, the internet.
In the mid-1990s, few people had access to the internet, and most had no idea what was on it. But there was a growing fear that this new form of communication was being misused.
For porn.
That it was being overtaken by porn.
In this country, we protect speech that some people in other countries find unpleasant, that some people in this country find unpleasant.
Chris Hansen was a lawyer working for the American Civil Liberties Union, defending the First Amendment, the right to free speech in the USA.
There are always people who say, I support the First Amendment, but, and then have whatever the exception is that they find persuasive. Often it is speech about sex, and when they came to the internet, that's where the fight began.
And I wonder, you personally, has there ever been a but for you?
No, because I don't want somebody else deciding what speech I can say and what speech I can hear.
It's pretty obvious with the early problems we've had here in America that the information superhighway, which is all part of the internet, should be made one that's safe for children. We've had several incidents here where pornography and smut have so overcome parts of the internet superhighway that it's alerted us to the fact that we should do something about it before it's too late.
Congressman James Exon, a Democrat, sponsored a new law banning indecent material on the internet, which could be accessed by children. The Communications Decency Act was signed into law in 1996. And the moment the ink was dry, Chris Hansen began building a case against it. But where to begin?
None of us at the ACLU had been on the internet. In order to educate ourselves about the internet, we found somebody in Washington, D.C. who had internet access. I was amazed by it. He took us to a couple of art museum sites. First, I think, to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. But then he took us to the Louvre in Paris. And in my mind at that time, the model of international communication was long-distance telephone calls, where you would call the operator and ask the operator to get you a line to Paris, and it would cost you an enormous amount of money to make a phone call to Paris. And he pushed one button, and suddenly we were receiving information from Paris. And that struck me as astonishing.
But it wasn't all art galleries on the internet, was it?
No. Well, initially it was an educational thing where universities talked back and forth to each other. But in the same way that people always worry that new methods of communication are going to show sex, people who want to show sex always take advantage of new methods of communication in order to show sex.
Chris Hansen had 20 law students scour the internet to find websites at risk of censorship, those which use sexually explicit language, but whose aim was not to titillate.
The law students at first thought this was just about the coolest assignment they had ever been given in their lives. But within about an hour, they discovered that in trying to find that, you end up having to look at a lot of really disgusting stuff. But we did ultimately find a lot of websites that fit the category we were looking for.
And chief among them were?
The example I often use is this Stop Prisoner Rape website set up by a man who had been raped when he was in prison and wanted to help other people who had gone through that experience. He told his story and invited other people who had been victims to tell their stories. There's a lot of discussion of extreme sexual acts, and yet it is entirely done for therapeutic reasons and for solidarity reasons and for public policy reasons. And we thought that was a perfect example of a website that should never, ever be censored.
But the ACLU also had its eye on history. it wanted to be the main named plaintiff. To do this, it had to create a website that would put it at risk of prosecution too. Chris Hansen had an idea. He went back to a previous historic case involving legendary American comedian George Carlin.
My trouble was I wanted a list. I didn't think it was asking much.
George Carlin's Seven Words You Can't Say monologue was played on public radio in the 1970s and ignited a debate about broadcasting and free speech, which ended up at the Supreme Court. Here's some more.
Here are these words I'm not supposed to say. Let's have a look at them. I'll be glad to avoid them if I could just see them and know what they are. You gotta say them to find out what they are, man.
And he did say them, repeatedly, but that's as far as we can go because the Supreme Court decided that public broadcasters in the US should not play them in case children are listening. The ACLU attached the Supreme Court ruling on the seven offensive words sketch to its brand new website and invited people to submit their own suggestions of dirty words.
Lots of people did that, and of course we quickly came to the realization that there are in fact more than seven dirty words in the English language.
And that was enough to get them a case to test the law. A special court was set up. None of the three judges hearing the case had ever accessed the internet.
And so we had to wire up the courtroom, which at that point seemed like a technological marvel. I remember thinking to myself, really? How can they get the internet into the courtroom? That doesn't make any sense at all. It's somewhere else. But we did, and we tried to show them websites that we thought they would be interested in. We did some research on the judges and found one of them is interested, for example, in opera. And so we found an opera website and showed the opera website so that the judge could see what it looked like on the internet.
Having established what the internet was, the ACLU then argued that the law censoring it, the Communications Decency Act, would not actually be enough to protect children.
The law had all sorts of problems. For example, it didn't reach overseas websites. There was no way a website in the UK or in Uganda was going to be prosecuted by US authorities. And so it was wildly unimpressive and under-inclusive.
The ACLU won, and the case was automatically referred to the Supreme Court. Chris Hansen says despite winning in the lower courts, few believed they'd convinced the highest court in the land.
There were a lot of people predicting that we were going to lose at the time. The reason being that because no one on the Supreme Court had been on the internet, they would be looking for an analogy. And the closest analogy was television. The internet at the time came into your house on a screen. You pushed a button like you turned on the TV. You chose the website the way you choose the channel. It felt an awful lot like analogous to television. And the Supreme Court had decided that in the context of television, you could in fact censor indecent speech.
But in the end, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of the ACLU, declaring that the Communications Decency Act was unconstitutional. While the internet has changed phenomenally since then, Chris Hansen thinks it is still highly resistant to censorship.
I think the internet has become the best form of communication, the freest form of communication the world has ever seen, and I sincerely hope it will remain that way.
Why you think the net was born? Born.
Tracky.
Chris Hansen was speaking to me, Claire Bowes, for Witness.
Oh, me sorry, me no mean to.